You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support the show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, May 5th, 2014. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, just hours before she will receive the 2014 Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism. Digby from the Uber blog, Hullabaloo. Also on the program, Satanists unveil their Satanist statue for Oklahoma. Meanwhile, maybe not a coincidence, new polls show that the uninsured rate of Americans in terms of health insurance is at its lowest since measures began to be taken. New reports out suggest that fracking may cause birth defects, and the clock is ticking on the tunnels that lead across the Hudson River. Smooth move, Chris Christie, in preventing another tunnel from being built. Also, the heartwarming story of a GOP state Senate candidate who was a former crossdresser and now, in his words, not anti-gay, just anti-gay marriage equality. And more on the horrific story of nearly 300 Nigerian girls who were kidnapped and now supposedly will be sold on the open market. All that and more on today's program. Want to first start by drawing your attention to a story, I believe it was in the New York Times. Two teams of scientists have published studies on Sunday, that would be yesterday, showing that blood from young mice reverses aging in old mice, rejuvenating their muscles and brains. It's long been theorized that this might be the case. Experiment indicated there were compounds in the blood of young mice that could awaken old stem cells and rejuvenate aging tissue. Likewise, the blood of old mice had compounds that dampened the resilience of young mice. Studies centered specifically around a protein called GDF11, which was abundant in young mice and scarce in old ones. This is just, I mentioned this both because it is a curiosity, and also as a programming note, if you notice that Matt and Michael seem to tire quite easily in the coming weeks and months, it may have something to do with the new transfusion technology that we have installed in the office, whereby I will be receiving.
It was very alarming to see an IV underneath the crying John Boehner poster.
Yes.
It was kind of astonishing addition.
We are just moments away from starting our own experiment here. We just need to get some rubbing alcohol. And those elastic-y things that make your veins pop. So if you notice a spring in my step in the coming months, it will either be because Matt and Michael's blood will be teeming through my body, or some of you have decided to become new members at the Majority Report. It'll be your call. Well, I may tie it directly into how many pints of blood I take from you on a given week will be in direct inverse proportion to how many new members we get at any given time, which you can sign up for at majority.fm.
Please become a member.
There you go. There's Matt's plea.
I had to skip WrestleMania.
All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Digby. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to the program the 2014 Hillman Prize for Opinion and Analysis Journalism, also now a recently minted contributor, writer for Salon.com, and of course the proprietor of the Uber blog Hullabaloo. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, it's Digby. Hi, Digby. Welcome back to the program.
Sam, thanks for having me.
So congratulations on all of it. It is, if not timely, it is at least long overdue recognition of your great writing. I'm very happy that you're being recognized tomorrow in New York City.
Yes, I'm thrilled, really honored, and quite shocked. You know, you and I remember maybe about a decade ago when the progressive movement online netroots internet upstarts were first starting off just kind of having a conversation with each other and, you know, trying to live through the Bush years. You know, I never expected anything to come of that. And over these years, you know, writing every day and just trying to keep up with everything that's been going on, it sort of turned into a vocation and then finally a career, which is kind of interesting for someone at my stage in life to have that happen. But I couldn't be more thrilled. It's really an honor. I mean, great writers like Ta-Nehisi Coates and Marcy Wheeler was honored with this a couple of years back as well. So I'm really thrilled, and I'm looking forward to the ceremony tomorrow.
Yeah, there are so many people who are so excited upon hearing this. So I think you know your excitement is shared by tens of thousands, as far as I can tell, who have been reading you for years. And tell us, will you have an address tomorrow night? I mean, what are some of the things you're gonna talk about?
Well, you don't have a lot of time. I mean, it's not like a big speech, so it's just going to be a few minutes. And you know, basically, I think, I mean, I'm still sort of deciding, but I think that what I will talk about is the fact I specifically, I mean, this is an honor that was given to me for the full, you know, decade of my daily blogging, and truly is daily. I mean, I write 7 days a week. Specifically, it was for my, you know, writing about economic and social justice over the past year and, you know, I think probably over the past 2 or 3 years. And so I think that's probably what I'm going to focus on, which is the fact that, you know, despite, and I don't think this was easy for people, despite the fact that we had a Democratic president And despite the fact that we had an economic crisis of epic proportions, I think it was very hard to be critical and skeptical of what was going on in Washington. And that was, I think, what I tried to do to the best of my ability, to try and keep a clear head and try to look at the behaviors of Washington, the village, what I call the village, which is the, you know, basically the political establishment, and try to analyze it as clearly as I could and give people a way to understand what was going on. And I think that effort, along with the efforts of many other progressives who were seeing the same things I was, we were able to at least put some pressure on the Democratic Party, as hard as that was to do, to not completely fall into the conventional wisdom that said that, you know, they had to cut entitlements, for instance, or any number of other things that were coming up during that period. There was at least a place where we were trying to push back on that and push the Democratic administration in the midst of this kind of chaotic time to recognize that there was going to be some pressure exerting from the left on this. And it was a very difficult thing to do. People were very enthusiastic about the new Democratic president. The health care bill was coming through. There was a lot going on. But this kind of intense focus that we tried to have, I think, in the progressive blogosphere and in other, you know, lefty publications, programs like yours, where we were just not buying it. And I think that that's probably what I will address, was this idea that there needs to be this independent outside force in progressive politics to push the Democratic Party and others on the left to keep their eyes on the prize when these things happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think in some ways the 2008 sort of lifted a veneer off of sort of what is a bigger sort of systemic and structural problem. I mean, I think during the Bush years, people were talking about inequality, but it was pegged directly to, what was perceived to be the Bush administration, when in fact it's sort of a much larger problem.
Well, exactly. And of course, that story has evolved and kind of bubbled up and emerged over the last few years, and very much so just within the last 6 months, I think, where I think it's become clear. I mean, perhaps, actually, I should say it's bubbled up over the last couple of years really strongly, probably starting with the fact that the Republicans nominated the poster boy for plutocracy in the last election. And that kind of vividly illustrated, I think, for people, for a lot of us, for what was going on. But, you know, this isn't a partisan problem. I mean, I think that's been demonstrated. We have a system that's marinating in money and is almost overwhelmed by it. And that's become very clear. And we used to see that through the partisan lens. I think it was easier to see that. I mean, that sort of falls into the kind of image and sort of stereotypes that we think of. And, of course, you know, the Republicans, let's not forget, I mean, they really are the poster boys for this. It's not, you know, the Democrats are doing it as well. But, you know, the Republicans, they're the ones who make a real profit at it. So, I think that that's been the story and will continue to be the story for some time to come. And it's been a very interesting educational process for someone like me, who had followed politics for decades, but had a certain kind of just fundamental understanding going back to, you know, freshman in college about, you know, what you do in recession and the idea that you would stimulate the economy when there was a lack of demand. I mean, these were really basic Econ 101 kind of concepts. And suddenly, here we were in the midst of this crisis and seeing something as bizarre as clear-cut criminal behavior on the part of the financial wizards on Wall Street, and being told that there wasn't anything that we could do about it because they were too big to fail and, you know, the economy was too fragile and things like that. I mean, that shook up my entire worldview, despite the fact that I think I was reasonably cynical about elites. This took it to a new level. So I think we're now sitting here watching this from a different place than we were 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, you know, I remember, I think Kevin Drum wrote something about how that episode in 2008, you know, I think he said it radicalized him. I don't know that it actually did, but I mean, he was, well, you know, he's someone who I think was, you know, sort of a centrist of sorts. And I don't know why that pops into my head as you're talking about how 2008 sort of reoriented everybody. I mean, one of the things, too, that strikes me that never got the emphasis that it should have was that it was really Newt Gingrich who attacked Romney more than anyone else, and I include President Obama in this, from almost like the populist, I don't know, left, but with populism. And it just goes to show just how reluctant, in some respects, how much it's even that much more dangerous for Democrats to do, because it's almost as if they're afraid that something like that would catch fire.
Well, I think that's true, don't you? I mean, isn't there? I mean, I keep hearing this, and I think that it's actually quite obvious at this point that the one thing that people fear at this point is populism, from whatever direction it's coming. I mean, whether it's Occupy or it's, you know, some Looney Tune with a bunch of automatic weapons running around in a militia. Whatever you want to say is that there's a feeling, I think, among the elites. For the first time, I mean, you would have thought that after 2008 they would have felt this immediately, just as a matter of survival. But they didn't, and it's a testament to their own sense of, you know, privilege that they didn't see this. But this kind of discontent, you know, it cannot hold. And I think that they're finally beginning to see this. I keep hearing, you know, sort of rumblings that even among the Democratic donor class, for instance, there's a, you know, an argument going on as to how they should embrace this populism and use it. And of course, the right has been, they've been professionalizing that particular strategy for many years on how to harness the populist right. And so there's a lot of very, very, let's just say, tremulous people with a lot of influence and money trying to figure out how to deal with this. And, of course, you know, to those of us who are following this, it really isn't that difficult. I mean, we, you know, you can look at the various solutions that are out there that would probably do some good. And I'm not saying it isn't complicated, but the idea of this vast wealth flowing to the top, and of course it seems to grow exponentially, right? I mean, the more they have, the more they make. I'm still struck by this amazing number to me that the Koch brothers in 2011 were worth $50 billion. They are now worth $100 billion. Now, I mean, that's just shocking. $100 billion. I mean, that's an amazing amount of money, and it shows. And they are politically dedicated, committed to changing the country, the world, and putting through policies and electing politicians who reflect their belief system, which is radical. It is very radical. And they have got $100 billion.
Yeah.
That's a lot of money to work with in politics, even by, you know, our overall standards. And so, you know, this is the kind of thing I think that I had never contemplated before. I mean, I have to admit that the last time I thought about stuff like this was when, you know, reading some history about the Gilded Age and thinking that the lessons had been learned. And evidently, that's not the case, and so we're sort of going into this in a you know, supercharged fashion at this point.
They could literally put in $500 million into every state in the country, which would basically change the politics in each one of those states dramatically. And they would still be back around what their 2012 net worth would be.
That's right.
If they wanted to do that tomorrow, it's been a 2-year, 3-year setback, but we'll get back on it. And
yeah, no problem. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, that's just, that's an outrageous number, isn't it? I mean, and the money that they are putting in, which everybody, you know, is, oh my gosh, you know, Sheldon Adelson's putting in $100 million and the Kochs are putting in this and blah, blah, blah. It's pocket change. I mean, it literally is pocket change. It's the equivalent of what, you know, I went down and spent at Trader Joe's yesterday, to my income. And these people can do this. And it's, and that should be disturbing. I often put up on my blog, and I put it up on an article in Salon too recently, this sort of, you know, this picture of what, you know, a $1 billion looks like.
Well, and do you think that the, I mean, this Piketty book has gotten so much attention, and this is the book. I mean, we've talked about it on this program, but this is it's a book put out by a French. I don't know if he's an economist, but it's more of like a economic history. The argument is made from sort of more a historical standpoint, and the theory is quite simple. Just as the economy grows, capital gets a rate of return that's greater than the economy. And it's a fairly straightforward argument. You know, if you have money, it's easier for you to make money at a rate faster than the economy grows, and then inequality grows. And to the extent that we've had periods in history where it hasn't been the case, those have been anomalies. What accounts for the, you know, you almost can't go to a website now that's not reviewing this book. It is, I certainly am not aware of any book that has gotten this much attention. What accounts for it? Do you think it's like a broader awareness of those at the top? I mean, it seems to me on some level, it's like in 2008, the wealthy were concerned with losing their money, and now in 2014 they realize, like, oh wow, we did a really good job in not losing our money. we have gotten virtually all the gains that have been made over the past 6 years. I wonder if that's going to be a problem. I mean, what's driving this?
Well, I think, I mean, the book is kind of it's creating a sensation among people who, you know, who think about this stuff for sure. And I mean, to me, it seems. And I have to say at the outset, I haven't read it, so, you know, I'm not going to comment.
Well, nobody
on
has.
The substance,
I think everybody's
but, yeah,
just
I
read
mean,
reviews.
We're just commenting
point.
On the comment on the atmosphere around it, which is very interesting. And the fact that I think that the way you just described the thesis, it's sort of backed up by common sense, right? People sort of know, you know, it takes money to make money, that kind of concept. But we've been living under this illusion, at least in America, and I don't know how this is being received over in Europe or elsewhere. But in America, you know, we had this American dream, right, which was really a dream of the middle class. It there was always the idea that you could perhaps become rich, you got lucky, you had a good idea, you could do certain, you know, follow certain rules and maybe you'd get ahead. But the essential American dream was the dream of a middle class, having a good job, being able to buy a house, better life for your children, that sort of thing. And it was a kind of a sense of economic security. People weren't going to fall backwards. You were always going to grow a little bit, generation to generation, and maybe some of you would jump up, you know, very, very much higher in the next generation. But this book and this sort of realization that we're having is that whole thing was kind of an accident, and that really the truth is that we were sort of, you know, there was a period of, as you say, you know, sort of anomalous kind of economic activity. And in the book, I believe it comes, specifically in the U.S., it comes from World War I through World War II, and all the events that transpired in between were the anomalous sort of events that created this possibility of a more equal, egalitarian economic system for a while. And now we've sort of gone back to the norm, where the rich get richer and everybody else just kind of struggles. So I think that there's this sense that, you know, well, yeah, we've been feeling that we've been losing our grip And this kind of validates the fact that historically that's always been the case. And, you know, I don't know how to feel about that. I mean, I don't know about you, but that makes me feel kind of despairing because I don't see the mechanism for how you change that. I'm not going to root for catastrophe.
Right. I mean,
and
it also seems as if there's almost like two separate conversations going on. There's sort of like one conversation going on within, you know, those people who look at politics and sort of contemplate, you know, see a connection between systems and policy, and then there's the sort of the other conversation that's going on that is really just about the sort of day-to-day politics, where there doesn't seem to be the sort of broader awareness. I mean, you link to a piece the other day, a conversation between Thomas Frank and Lewis Lapham on sort of how, I guess, sort of revolutionary drive is sort of consumed by the beast and then sort of spit back out in a sort of more processed form. I mean, you know, just today there were polls out showing that the Republicans are perhaps on the verge of a Republican wave. And there's just a broad sense that something's wrong. And there's, you know, the answer is, well, it's just vote in, you know, the party that's not in power. I guess the challenge is, you know, how does the rubber meet the road, as it were? I mean, how in the sort of culture that we have today in society, does the idea that, like, look, things are one way because of a sort of a broader systemic problem, how does that end up getting translated to people who don't really pay attention to this stuff?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, honestly,
You won the Hillman Prize. I know you know the answer, Digger.
I wish I did. Then I could, you know, win a bunch of prizes, I have no doubt, if I had the answer to that question. I do think that there is some value in this, you know, rising sense of populism. And I think that for me, and I don't know, I'm not going to try and address the long-term systemic problem through this, but just in terms of the political problem, you know, we have this issue with money in politics, and it's infecting both parties to such an extent that we almost feel like, you know, we're being drowned in it. It's very difficult to see how you get beyond that particular stranglehold. But there, you know, democracy still does sort of exist. I mean, we do still have a vote, and the rich people do only get one vote. And to the extent that there is something interesting happening, I see the Democrats are starting to sense that there is value in clarity, in portraying themselves as different from the Republicans. And that's a first that I've seen in the last 25 years, really since Reagan, where the Democratic strategists are seeing that there is some usefulness. And you're seeing this in some of these red state Senate races, where they're actually kind of coming up with their own populist messaging, which is unusual for them, because normally what they would be doing is trying as hard as they can to blur the distinctions between them and the Republicans. Maybe it's a desperation move. I don't know. They just right. They figure, hey, you know, it's we're losing anyway, so let's just go for it. But that would not be like them. You know, that would be very unusual for Democrats to look at anything that way. So, you know, it may be that what we're coming to in our two-party system is a period of intense clarity, a real political argument, one in which we're going to see some, you know, people being able for the first time in a long time to see a real division between the two parties, two very distinct philosophies and ideologies driving them. Now, I'm saying all that within the context of big money still running everything. So whether or not that's even possible, I don't know. Maybe we'll have some, you know, rich liberal plutocrats who will decide that they want to, you know, that they want to finance something like this. So, you know, that, I mean, it's a, there's a possibility that we may be coming into a period where the lines are more starkly drawn. Now, maybe that's a bad thing. I don't happen to think so. I think that people, you know, that we still, if we believe that we have some kind of a democratic system, it's a good idea for people to know what they're voting for and to have a real sense of what that is.
You've written about, obviously we're talking at a time where now we have a select committee on Benghazi. We have, for all intents and purposes, getting away from sort of the policy issues that we might have with Obamacare, at least from a media narrative, the material is there to say that it's been a success. It doesn't seem to be getting to the American public, and I would also sort of suggest that the problems that the American public have with it, you know, short of about 15% of us, don't perceive the problems as being it doesn't go far enough. It's still considered the devil spawn by that huge swath of people who are going to be, actually, I think, going out to the polls because of Benghazi. Aside from the fact that this Benghazi stuff, I think, is only just sort of like fuel for the people who are already going to vote, the Republican base, I don't think it's going to affect anybody else's vote. And I sort of feel the same way about Obamacare. But assuming for a moment, let's just take a brief look into the future. What happens in terms of specifically what President Obama does in the event that there is a Senate and a House controlled by Republicans? This, as sort of, I don't know, annoyed as I am and disappointed in many aspects about what President Obama has done with the current political climate, I am really, really nervous about a Senate and House controlled Republican by the Republicans and then President Obama, because I think it sort of like plays into the worst impulses of the Obama administration.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. We've actually talked a little bit about this before, not specifically with the Congress being, you know, fully in the hands of the Republicans, but in what Obama was going to do in his, you know, final years, how he was going to play this out. And I still think that his impulse, maybe I'm being too generous here. I mean, I've been very, very hard on the guy from the minute that he took office, so I don't think anybody can call me an Obama apologist. But I actually don't think he wants his legacy to be the legacy of, you know, Republican toady, or I don't know that he wants him to be seen as having been the guy who said, you know, the era of big government is over, like Clinton was. I don't know. I mean, none of us do.
Right.
He does have those impulses. Perhaps he thinks it's better to, quote, get something done than to not. And then there's the complication of his successor, who presumably will be Hillary Clinton, under tremendous pressure from the Benghazi scandal or God knows what else they're going to dredge up, and feeling like he needs to set the table for her to be seen as less, you know, of a liberal icon than, you know, people like to portray her. And, of course, if they lose big in this election, there's always that issue of everybody running scared and saying, oh my God, we went too far to the left, let's tack back immediately, we've got to become even more right wing. As you know, that will be their instinct, thus erasing everything I just said about the clarity and all of that,
right,
for another couple of cycles until they finally wake up and one more time. So, you know, it's a very complicated set of issues for any president in this particular, situation. But there's also this, and I don't know if Obama and his people are sanguine about it or recognize it, but I actually believe that this was inevitable. I mean, you know, it's just, it's very, very difficult. It, you know, historically, these second midterms of a president's second term are, you know, they're bloodbaths. They're just bloodbaths. You know, Bush had a bloodbath.
Right.
I mean, Clinton only survived
when,
a bloodbath.
Right. 2006 is when the Democrats took control of the House and the Senate, or and the Senate, I believe.
Yeah. And you know, look, and Clinton survived, but it's because they overreached so badly with the impeachment.
Right.
That, you know, he didn't. They kept, you know, they had the Congress already, obviously. But they had anticipated, you know, winning a bunch more seats, and they ended up losing some seats, but they didn't lose the majority. I mean, this is just the way these things tend to go, and I think that it has to do with just, you know, people are tired of the administration at that point, whatever is going on, even, you know, unless it's really mourning in America. And even then, I mean, look at what was happening with Clinton. The economy was roaring. It was as booming as it's ever been. I never made more money in my life than I did during that second term of Clinton's. Mm. And, it, you know, so there was a lot of, you know, of good reason to believe that they might do okay. And the Republicans took care of that and basically, you know, they impeached him. And so, you know, I just don't, I can't imagine that the Obama administration, that they haven't anticipated this to some extent and recognized their lame duck status and understood that his, let's just put it this way, his legacy will not be enhanced by accommodating the Republicans of 2014. I mean, these people are crazy. And they're going to be, you know, they're going to be subpoenaing Hillary Clinton so they can grill her, his successor, his Secretary of State. Let's just put it this way. I'm keeping my fingers crossed that they don't panic and that that he holds the line. If he does hold the line, I think he stands her in much better stead than if he doesn't.
My biggest fear is just that this administration seems to have, at the very least, on some level, and you know, sort of updated it for the times because it just wouldn't work in this age. But they still look at that Clinton administration, and I'm just afraid that, like, things like the 96 Telecommunications Act, the welfare reform, the mm-hmm. Repeal of Glass-Steagall, what was it, the Graham? Wiley, that those sort of stick out as potential models, you know, and we will then sort of be, have to, I guess, rely on the sheer insanity of the Republicans to not say yes, you know, to not take yes for an answer. And that's
well, that's the story of the Obama administration, I'm afraid. I mean, if, you know, it's the insanity of the Republicans not taking yes for an answer. And, you know, I don't know how much longer we can count on that, but so far, I mean, you've got people like Rick Santorum, who, you know, he's a certified lunatic. And he's running around talking about how they should be raising the minimum wage. And you've got Paul Ryan pretending to care about inner cities. So there's some awareness among Republicans that their insanity has become a liability. So I don't know, you know, can they put together a program that Obama could present to everyone as being a great bipartisan achievement?
Let's hope not. That's the only thing I can say about that. And
well, he has one, actually. He has one, and that he can point to as a great bipartisan achievement, and that is the successive austerity budgets
right.
that have basically crippled the, you know, the federal discretionary budget. And that was, you know, those budgets came in, are now lower than Paul Ryan's original budget in 2010. So, you know, to that extent, I think he can take great pride in the fact that he achieved bipartisan consensus on cutting the living hell out of the government.
And we see the, you know, we see the direct impact of it in terms of government hiring, which has been the sort of the biggest drag on the economy.
Yeah, exactly. If, you know, had that government cuts across the board from federal on down to local, not been done, we would have come out of this recession much, much, much more vibrantly and much earlier.
All right. Well, let's before you go, let's give us your best guess as to what happens with Benghazi. Now over the next 6 to 8 months. I mean, this is, and then I guess it's off to the races if they control the Senate, because then you'll get a bicameral, I imagine, special select committee. I hope I'm not responsible for paying some type of trademark fee in saying the words Benghazi at this point.
Contribute
$25 to Daryl Issa. But I mean, so how does this, I mean, based upon, the way that we know the scandal gates worked during the Clinton administration, where do they take this?
Well, I think, my personal belief, you've looked at this scandal, right? I mean, you look at the details and you see that there is no scandal. This is not a scandal. Certainly not one.
But there's no accountability. We haven't been told the truth that what they knew when they knew it.
Right. Other than having, there was Laura Logan dragging out some con artist. He provided some great, facts that proved to be a hoax. Other than that, we have a very basic story that, of we were in a hot spot, an ambassador went there, blah, 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 that was terrible what happened. This happens in embassies, happened, I don't know, half a dozen times during the Bush administration. True, an ambassador was killed here, but he was kind of an intrepid guy who liked to go into very dangerous places. And then there was the fog of war versus the idea that there was some kind of a conspiracy to cover up. That's basically the story. And there's not a real scandal there other than, who saw the talking points first. And, the whole scandal happened within like a 48-hour period, according to these people. In any case, when you look at it, you can see that there's really nothing to hang on to. But they have... they have perfected the art of taking what is a complicated story, and they create they put a brand name onto it. This one's Benghazi, and I always put it with an exclamation point afterwards. It's like Whitewater or Chinagate or Watergate or whatever. And they've created a brand out of this. And what they do is that they just keep, dribbling out. New bits of information that aren't new at all, but they say that they're new, and just pump the scandal to the point where people who are not paying attention, and they shouldn't have to. No American citizen who isn't a political junkie like me or like you should ever have to look at something this ridiculous and even think about it. And so most people don't. Even people who follow it, certainly the ones who are following it on Fox News, have no idea what really went on. They get the sense that where there's smoke, there's fire. And that is what happens with these Clinton scandals. And I think that they quite wisely are piggybacking on that old sense. Young people aren't going to remember what this was like, and they're not going to vote for the Republican anyway. What they're aiming at, I think, are older people, many of whom are already their voters, and perhaps some a little bit younger than are, normally voting for Republicans, who look at this sort of thing and go, here we go again.
Right.
And maybe even not even think it consciously, but just have that feeling. And those of us who followed those Clinton scandals, who are old enough to remember them and remember, how this stuff was churned up over and over and over again, we get that sense with Benghazi. That's the sense they're creating. And it's a very, very effective tool for Republicans, and it has been. It's interesting that they couldn't really do it with Obama. And not because Obama's particularly, untainted by scandal, but because I think that there was something, he's younger. He didn't have the kind of, and he didn't come from, one of the, they tried in the campaign to do it with his Chicago connections.
Right.
You remember there was some guy that he bought his house and it was, a weird mortgage or something. But it didn't really click with him because the Clintons, coming from that weird Byzantine political world of Arkansas and being baby boomers and having all of that baggage and going on and on. And now, Hillary being the sort of, next phase of the dynasty. I think that they know that this is a very, if nothing else, it's great for their media, right?
I think there's a lot of people making, this is it's a business for a lot of people. It's a cottage industry. And it seems to me that, to sort of bring this back to the beginning, that, when you started blogging at that time, Benghazi, it seems to me, would have gone sort of big time. You know, it would have been just the sort of the off-Broadway show or even the Broadway show. They'd have a movie about it, and then they would have a full merchandising. And they can't seem to get it. I mean, aside, and people should not mistake the fact that the reason why they can't get it, they can't sort of take it big, is because there's nothing there. They've done that before with things that were nothing there. They can't seem, they no longer have the ability, it seems to me, to sort of infect the broader bloodstream in the same way that they did 10 years ago. Is that your sense too?
Well, I think that that's true, and I think it may be because they've kind of ghettoized themselves. Their vast success with Fox and with talk radio, and even their own right-wing internet has kind of, in a weird way, it's created a bubble for them that unless you're hooked into that bubble, you don't get it. And the mainstream media, I will go ahead and take partial credit, as should you and should all the media critics of that early time during the Bush years. They would have jumped on this with, it would have been.
That seems to me to be the big difference.
24/7.
And I don't know if it's because now, you don't hear the producers at every cable news show saying the first thing I do is look at Drudge in the morning. There's a lot of
Drudge
other
rules our world, right? Wasn't that what he said?
Yeah. I wonder if that's the biggest change, in which makes it sort of, it helps them at the midterms, but it's not going to help them at the national elections when you actually get a broader sort of, a wider range of people who come out that I think, Benghazi for them means nothing.
Well, and I think part of it is, this is actually maybe more salient. I suspect that Republican strategists get that they have a big national problem, and that they're not going to be able to get a national majority again, barring, events changing the whole calculus. But assuming everything goes, as per normal, they have a problem. And their idea will be to use their minority status, which they're very, very good at. We've seen that with the Obama administration, to hobble any Democratic administration. Whether they're in the majority in the Congress or in the minority, they have the ability to do it. We've seen them do it. Scandal mongering is one of the ways they do it. They distract, they are a distraction to any president. They are very, very difficult to deal with. And even if the mainstream media isn't treating it with the same kind of excited, sort of stimulation that they did back in the 90s, it's still a distraction if you've got people who are being subpoenaed and you've got this sort of thing. And I wouldn't trust the mainstream media, by the way, not to jump on this if it can get some traction. But for right now, they're not seeing this as something that is worthy. And in fact, if you look at MSNBC, which tilts more liberal or more Democratic anyway, they've got the Christie scandal has been a much bigger story there. So in that sense, both sides are sort of ghettoized in their little scandal zones, and are, sort of working those stories in similar fashion, but, on each side. And neither one of those probably broke through to the big national, oh my God, something terrible's happened kind of level that you would see with Whitewater or with, certainly with Monica Lewinsky. But I think the possibility is still there. It's simmering under the surface. And Benghazi is a perfect, in some ways, it's a perfect right-wing scandal because it's completely incomprehensible. And that's really the hallmark of a good right-wing, scandal. Because what they, the last thing, I mean, I don't know if you ever tried to untangle Whitewater.
Oh, Whitewater, it was intertwined with Travelgate and Vince Fostergate.
Absolutely. And then there was Johnny Chung, there was the Buddhist Temple. I mean, it went on and on and on.
That's the thing is, I don't think that people, under the age of 30 maybe even under the age of 40, really appreciate. Just no. That's all it was. It was constant. I mean, it was relentless, and it wasn't just in the fever swamps, right? I mean, it was, this is what, you know, I mean, it would be interesting to go back and just like pull the NBC News, you know, because of course in the early 90s, there was, I think maybe you had CNN and that was basically it. And then it was all network news. But every other night it was, you know, Jennings and who else was
Brokaw, Jennings, rather.
Talking yep. about Travelgate and Whitewater Gate and Vince Foster Gate and it was crazy. But
it was an overwhelming atmosphere of scandal. And you know, to be honest, and I'll cop to this myself, as a political junkie, it was fascinating. I mean, I couldn't get enough of it. I mean, I could see why news people were just consuming this like crazy, because it was really fascinating. It was, you know, oh my God, you know, what's next? And there was, but of course that was part of the Clinton thing, was this high wire act that you always felt with him. I mean, going back to the campaign in 92, it was that sense of he's teetering, he's going to go, and you know, you ended up sort of feeling that for a solid 8 years. And I suspect, and I think that that's part of the attempt here to sort of reignite that, is a sense that, you know, they want to recreate the idea that Clinton being in office, Hillary this time, will be a replay of that, which is very good for business, by the way, very good for the right-wing business. I mean, gazillions. They created the modern wingnut welfare
right.
Industrial complex through that. Fox News was made on the backs of that. This was a very, very lucrative thing for them, and it also created all of their stars, their media stars. I mean, that was a hugely successful. Maybe, you know, a reprise of the Clinton years in that way. Now, I don't know if it would work, because you have a completely different media landscape.
A different media landscape. And I think, you know, even part of the whole Clinton thing was that, you know, he was the comeback kid before he even got into office. I mean, that's the way that they referred to him in the beginning. And it was almost like he needed, I'm not psychoanalyzing him. I'm analyzing that sort of that media construct. You know, he needed these challenges, and in some way that fed into it. It was like, let's see if he can get past this one, and let's see if he can get past that one. And it became this sort of national, like, you know, like Dallas. It was like, you know, it was like Larry Hagman's
character. It was a soap opera.
And
it was a soap opera, and it went, you know, and it, a very significant one. And let's face facts, he was vastly helped by the fact that he had a roaring economy, which you know, they took credit for, and perhaps to some degree, you know, with some validity. But there was also this tremendous tech boom that just it set everything. They started off in a recession in 92, and by the end of his term, I mean, the whole country was economically on fire. That's a very helpful thing, and it was almost a luxury that it allowed the soap opera to be, you know, to be so prevalent. And there was no war, right? I mean,
well, there was a bunch of low-level conflicts. I mean, I think that there was constantly sort of priming the pump in a way, you know, with Kosovo, and it seemed there was always some kinetic activity. Just enough to sort of, you know, keep the dollars flowing, even though we supposedly had that peace dividend.
You bet. There was never any question that we were going to keep those dollars flowing, and we did. And in fact, Clinton got his clean war, right? I mean, not one American casualty in Kosovo, which was like, you know, the ultimate sort of expression of 90s American can-do goodness, right? I mean, it was perfect. And so he, you know, there was this luxury feeling that we could indulge in this soap opera and kind of wallow in political scandal, much of it very small bore, you know, the whole idea that we were gave a damn about, you know, the Rose Law Firm in the 1980s and things like
right.
that. I mean, it's like, what, you know? But so we were kind of wallowing in it, and had there been anything more important happening, not that there wasn't, but you know what I mean. It was just, it was a rather uneventful time geopolitically and economically. We were doing well. I don't know that it could have happened, and that is not going to be the case for Hillary Clinton.
That's right.
I mean,
there's
going to
be there's too much genuine, I think, dissatisfaction amongst people in general. I think to get caught up in the sort of in this weird soap opera, you know, where with the Larry Hagman character. I mean, honestly, that's just sort of what the 90s felt to me. And I think, like, you know, sort of in some respects, the impeachment was the best thing to happen to President Clinton in terms of his favorables, because
yep.
it just sort of suddenly it was just sort of the denouement, I guess, where everyone was just mm-hmm. like, yeah, the Republicans are morons, but let them have this. And, you know, we still love JR or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Let me ask you something, Sam, while I have you here. Who do you think the Republicans are going to come up with? I mean, what do you think is going to happen? Because I am really stymied on, and this is the first time I can remember that. To me, it's always been pretty obvious who the Republicans were going to nominate, and I don't see it.
I think Scott Walker is a sort of may have an opportunity. I don't think Jeb Bush is actually going to run at the end of the day.
I don't either. And I think he's the Fred Thompson of this.
Yes, definitely. And I think, you know, someone like Scott Walker, I don't know. I don't remember a time where it seems like this, the lack of obviousness seems to be sort of the major theme here. I mean, I think it's I don't know. I mean, I think Scott Walker, I think maybe, who knows, maybe, you know, even Kasich, he hasn't really talked about it. I feel like it's going to be someone of that ilk, someone who's going to come out of the Midwest. I don't think it's going to be any of the senators who are going to be vying for it. I don't know. It's a great question, but you know.
Well, it's very interesting to me, because this is not this is a sign of a different Republican Party. They anoint their leaders. This isn't something. It's not like the Democrats, where it's all, any open, you know,
right.
primary or open election. It's a free for all, and anything can happen. The Republicans, you know, it's pretty well set up. They, you know, they make their decision. It's somebody who's usually, it's their turn. They've been a, you know, big name for a while, and there's a good reason for it. I just don't see it this time. I mean, I thought that Chris Christie was the logical choice, but he's damaged goods, and that may not happen, although it would be a fascinating, from the perspective of a blogger, political junkie, the fight between Christie and Clinton,
I
scandal thing, would be fascinating.
I had a brief moment where I thought Christie had some potential sometime in the fall, I think. But aside from that, he just seems to me to be the guy who drops out in New Hampshire, you know, the day after New Hampshire, when it finds out,
yeah,
like, even there, he can't cut it. I don't know. It's going to be interesting, because I think, you know, all of the dynamics are such that the Republican Party is a different beast when it goes from primary to the general. And the one thing that Mitt Romney showed was that you can't really escape the primaries. And,
right.
you know, I still contend that when the Obama administration put out those Health and Human Service rules on birth control, they knew exactly what they were doing. They were basically throwing in a piece of, you know, into the primary,
yep.
and saying to the social conservatives, here's your big piece of meat to chew on. Let's see if Mitt Romney's forced to jump into that arena. And he was, and that was all she wrote. I imagine somewhere there is some institutional memory about that, and we'll see something like that again. So I don't know. I think it's just the real question is will if it's Clinton or whomever, will they feel they have to tack to the right during that, you know, to get there anyways, or will this be so far gone? And part of that, I think, has to do with what happens in this fall. But I don't want to hold you on the line so that you miss the ceremony tomorrow night in New York. But Digby, again, congratulations. I'm going to be
Thank
there
you.
Rooting for you in the audience.
Yay.
And really, really happy that you've been recognized in this way. And thanks so much for your time today.
Sam. And I hope I will be able to see you tomorrow night.
Yes.
And,
well, I'll be jumping up and down on the table when
Excellent.
You brought up.
So. I'll look for you jumping in the audience.
Okay.
thanks for having me, Sam.
All right, folks. Oh, geez. We went a little bit. Wow. We went very long. We're going to take a break, head into the funner half of the program, if that's possible at this point, we've got a special mix for members of our of the interview with Walter Block. It's still a work in progress, but and I hope I'm not stepping on Jimmy Reefer Cake's toes. I hope somebody's going to show up with a song on Friday. But in the funner half, we'll talk about that former drag queen who is now running for state senate as a Republican. And the fun that's all involved in fracking, causing potential birthday effects.
Yeah, you really almost had it.
Almost had it.
You really did.
How about that Satan story?
There you go.
And
Is
we
that
also
the new thing?
Oh, and we also have the latest ad from Iowa Republican Senate candidate Joni Ernst. Do you remember her? She was the one who talked about cutting pigs' penises off. And now she has apparently bought a leather jacket on Sky Mall and shown everybody. There we go. She's going for the business traveler. All right, we're going to take a break. 646-257-3920 is the number. You can IM me at Majority FM. Folks, it's your support that keeps this program going. Become a member today at majority.fm. Remember, when you become a member, we will, within the next 24 hours, send you an email with all of your membership information. If you don't get it within 24 hours, certainly email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com, but check your spam filter, because very often it gets caught in your spam filter, and then a month later, you're like, I never got my membership creds. And I'm like, what? What the... So become a member today. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And if you buy crap from Amazon, head over to majorityreportkickback.com, click on the Amazon link, bookmark it, buy all your crap that you buy from Amazon through that link, we get a kickback. Thus, majorityreportkickback.com. All right, see you in the better half.
Hey.